we see pieces of the CMB, and here they are plotted correctly. And if you make some mistakes in Mathematica, you'll find you plotted incorrectly. And the question is if you can just look at this and see what's incorrect about this plot. It's not the color. Okay, so what?
What looks suspicious?
Looks suspicious. Yeah, well, this is what cosmologists do. They look at the sky and try to see something. And so this one has structures mostly at 45 degrees. And the mistake that leads to that one is that all the momenta are in the upper right quadrant. All the momenta, so this was generated with momenta which are all positive. So positive kx and positive ky. They are mostly in the upper right quadrant, and so they privilege fluctuations that are opposite to that momentum. But anyway, so that was an example. No more talk about that now. But this highlights the difference between what Kepler was doing and what we are doing, right? So Kepler was trying to fit the universe into regular solids, very simple solid, very geometrically simple objects. And on the other hand, the predictions that we have for our universe are completely statistical, right? So we are looking only for statistical patterns. We're not predicting the precise shape, but we're predicting statistical properties of the shape. And that has to do with the nature of quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics doesn't predict a unique thing, but it predicts statistics. And in fact, when you have a statistical prediction, we have a simple distribution. The simplest possible distribution is a Gaussian, right? That's the simplest statistical distribution you can think about. If we were talking about simple shapes, you would think about the circle or things like this. That's the simplest shape, let's say. But if you're thinking about statistical distributions, the Gaussian is the simplest. And then as in gravity, so you can, Newtonian gravity, so the circle was Ptolemaeus and so on based their system, so just circles, the perfect figure. And we know in Newtonian gravity we have ellipses, just something slightly different. And here we'll see that in Einstein gravity we'll not have a Gaussian distribution for these fluctuations, but we'll have some small non-Gaussian corrections. And some of the information will be in these small non-Gaussian corrections. So I'll be talking today mostly about these small non-Gaussian corrections and what type of information we can get from it. But before I talk about the non-Gaussian correction, let me just give a short review of the Gaussian answer, which is what we computed last time. So what we have seen is that inflation produces a Gaussian distribution, and a Gaussian distribution is characterized by the two-point function. So we have a distribution for the curvature fluctuations in Fourier space, k prime, and this is equal to, first let's write the important factor, 1 over 2 epsilon h squared over m Planck squared. And then there were some factors that had to do with the conformal symmetry, and then some simple delta functions for momentum conservation. So this is the statistical homogeneity of the universe. And these were evaluated at some specific times, T star and T star. And well, 2 epsilon, so 2 epsilon could be written as phi dot squared over rho dot squared m Planck squared, or equal to m Planck b prime over b all squared, right? And this is small when the potential is flat, and the potential has to be flat in order to have a period of inflation. So that's the distribution for the scalar fluctuations. And in experiment, what people have measured, starting from COBE until Planck, they measured the amplitude. So they measured this amplitude of the fluctuations. And it's some number of 8.7 times 10 to the minus 8. So it's a concrete number for this. And they've also measured the, as I mentioned, the spectral index. So due to the fact that this is evaluated at some time, which corresponds to the time that the mod k crosses the horizon, there is some k dependence, some dependence on k of this factor, so that we don't have the exact scale invariant answer, but we have a small deviation. And so the small deviation can be parameterized as k over some k zero to the power ns minus 1. For some silly historical reasons, this is ns is measured from 1. But so they measure this deviation from 1, which tells us the violation from scale invariance. So then we have a similar result for the gravity wave. So the gravity waves can have circular polarization around the momentum k or around the opposite momentum. So there are possibilities here of having plus or minus are the circular polarization components in the direction of the momentum. And this is almost exactly the same expression, but the difference is that there is no epsilon. And then again, 1 over 2 k cubed, well, the same factor of 2 pi cubed of the cube k plus k prime. So here, the thing to notice is that we don't have this epsilon. As I mentioned, the epsilon is small, so this is bigger than this. Okay, and this epsilon is roughly bigger than about 3 or 4%. So epsilon, sorry, smaller than about point. Well, let's say just to be safe, 0.04. So this is bigger than this, and in addition, there are some reasons why. These gravity wave fluctuations are a little harder to see than the ordinary fluctuations. And for that reason, that's part of the reason why these gravity fluctuations have not yet been seen. But they could be seen at any time. And in fact, about over a year ago, there was an announcement that they had been seen, which actually turned out to be wrong. But well, that just shows that at any moment they will see them. They could see them at least. I mean, it wasn't such a ratio thing that it couldn't be true. I mean, it wasn't true because of some, they didn't take into account dust and so on, but it could have been true. Very good. So what this is saying is that we have a wave function for the universe. Have some probability of seeing, let's ignore for the moment the metric. So we have some probability of seeing particular function of x. So we have some function of x here. And the prediction of the theory is not what function we're going to see, but this probability distribution. And this probability distribution, as I said, is a Gaussian. I'll just try to write it explicitly. So we have some integral d3k. And then for each k mode, so we can represent it either in position or momentum space. So momentum space is this Gaussian kernel is diagonal. So here, the variables of the wave function are the psi k's. And then what we need to say is what's the amplitude or the variance of this Gaussian. And the variance is 1 over that two-point function, essentially up to factors of 2, which I'm not including here, is essentially what appears there in the two-point function. And of course, you know that when you calculate the two-point function of a Gaussian, this two-point function is proportional to the variance, right? So the what appears here in the denominator. Okay, so that's the Gaussian, and so I just wrote this to make it clear that we are talking about the Gaussian, and of course it's Gaussian because the recall that we were saying that we had a system of harmonic oscillators, and the wave function of the ground state of a harmonic oscillator is a Gaussian. Just we are seeing this Gaussian, okay? So the Gaussian of the ground state wave function of the harmonic oscillators. So when we computed the entanglement and so on, we're also talking about these Gaussian wave functions of the harmonic oscillators when we compute entanglement for free fields, for example. And we're analyzing various properties. And indeed, when we are looking at the universe at long distances, we are actually seeing this the same thing. So we are seeing this wave function of the ground state. Of course, amplified through inflation. So now we're going to talk about the non-Gaussian corrections. So non-Gaussian. And these non-Gaussian corrections come from the non-linearities of the equation. So I said yesterday that the wave function is determined by the Lagrangian, and the Lagrangian is not purely quadratic. It has some interactions. It has the nonlinear interactions of gravity, for example. At the very least, we have those. And in fact, it turns out that those are the dominant ones when we think about a system that is doing slow roll inflation. The reason is that, you might think, so that the first naive idea you have is that what could be the first correction to a Gaussian? The first correction to a Gaussian could be, we add a term here in the exponent, which involves a cubic term in psi, in zeta. So your first naive idea is that, well, perhaps the potential contains a phi cubed term. And so this is a reasonable idea, but it turns out that the slow roll condition implies that the coefficient of the phi cubed is so small that actually there are other terms that are more important. And the other terms that are more important have to do with the non-linearities of the equations. So we have the Einstein action, which contains a G Newton in front. And you know that once you canonically normalize the fields and so on, the non-linearities, especially a three-point function, will be of order the square root of G Newton. So that's the size of gravitational interactions. And so the square root of G Newton is 1 over M Planck. And then the other scale that appears is H. So the Hubble. So we need to put in some energy. And the typical energies of these fluctuations, that they have wavelengths of the order of the size of the horizon. And so their typical energies are of order H. And so the typical size of gravitational couplings or gravitational interactions is this. So G effective. So this is the effective coupling of this system. So H divided by M Planck. And this is, so is this clear that this is the size of the interactions? This is an important point. So if it's not clear, I'm happy to explain it in more detail. So let's analyze the size of interactions. So we want to consider we have gravitons that interact. So the first linear approximation is free gravitons. And so let's expand the Einstein action as dh squared. So that's the free gravitons. Plus then we can have terms of the form h dh squared. So this is roughly the form of the action. We have a quadratic term and then a cubic term, and then we have higher order terms. But then we can canonically normalize the fields so that we define a field H tilde, which will be H divided by square root of G Newton. Okay? And in terms of H tilde, this same action we're talking about here as gravity will have the form dH tilde squared plus square root of G Newton H tilde dH tilde squared, right? So then here, all propagators and so on will be of order 1. And this interaction vertex will be of order G Newton. Okay. So G Newton is dimensionful. And what makes up the dimension, so the only other scale in the problem, is H. And so that's what appears in in that effective coupling that we've written before. So the effective coupling is H over M Planck. Okay. So so that's just an order of magnitude calculation. So we would think that the coefficient of this correction, so the coefficient of the correction in the three-point function, so let me just write it here, plus zeta q, and that the coefficient will be of order of that effective coupling that we were talking about, and that coefficient was of order h over m Planck. Okay. Well, actually, in the, so that would be in canonical normalization where we compare this to 1. So in other words, if we computed the three-point function and we divide it by the two-point function to the power 3/2, okay? So that would be the changes in the three-point function. So the three-point function in units was the variance of the two-point function, right? This is really the sort of dimensionless way to see what the corrections are. And so that we expect to be of order h over m Planck. We'll see that this is actually not entirely correct, but this is a good first order of magnitude. We'll get to the more correct answer in a second. So the important point here is that is to see how big this is, right? So this that's a very small number. So we already we've already seen that this number here. Let me just give you what the number is here. So, so that's this whole number is about 8.7 times 10 to the minus 8. Okay. And I've already said that epsilon is less than 1. So this h over m Planck will be roughly less than about 10 to the minus 4, right? So this stuff is about less than 10 to the minus 4, or perhaps even smaller. That's a very small number. Okay, so this means that this statistical distribution we're talking about is very, very close to Gaussian. And as an exercise, so in your computer, you can plot a Gaussian, right? And then plot another function, which is e to the minus x squared plus 10 to the minus 4 times x cubed, right? And try to notice the difference, okay? Try to notice the difference. And then I will tell you that people, so the, especially the people from the Planck satellite collaboration, they've looked at the maps of the sky and they put some bounds on non-Gaussianity. I'll explain a little more what they did, but they are of this order. So they've done a task with real data that looks difficult to your eyes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, so in order to right now, sometimes if you know a little bit about this and how the data is presented, so this is really not conceptually important. What I'm going to discuss now is only important if you actually want to read the papers. Typically quoted in units, which is not this, which is the one they should do, but they computed dividing by the two-point function squared. Okay, again for some historical reasons. I don't ask. Well, I could tell you why. And they call this essentially FNL. Okay, there are some numbers of order one here I don't want to discuss. And so if you look at the if you look at the results, so there is the current bound is this FNL defined in this way is less than about 1, well, or 2. Okay, and that number corresponds essentially to non-Gaussianity of order 10 to the minus 4. So if they did this, it would be look much more impressive, you know, less than 10 to the minus 4. So here it looks like non-Gaussianity of order 1. Okay, now we can ask, so this is the experimental bound, and the the actual computation. So you can actually do the computation. So I've been talking about the order of magnitude of the answer. So I've talked about the order of magnitude, some naive estimate that we can do without doing any calculation. And then I've talked about the experimental answer. And now we can talk a bit more about doing the precise calculation. And the calculation is done by taking, it's essentially the same as, conceptually the same as what we discussed yesterday, except that more messy. And I won't go through it. But you take the action, you expand it to a third order, and then you do the calculation of the expectation value to, well, there's a piece in the action which is quadratic. This piece we treat as yesterday, and this one we treat it as a first order perturbation, and then you do the computation. So it's conceptually simple. In detail, it has some small little details you have to worry about, but I won't go through them. And the final answer is that this three-point function, divided again by the two-point function as people like to do, is not of order one, but turns out to be of order epsilon. So it's a little smaller than we first estimated. So we first estimated that it would be of order h over m Planck, which is also roughly the size of the two-point function. And then, but there is this extra factor of epsilon here, and turns out that if we had written it this way, there would be a square root of epsilon here, and another square root comes from the extra division by the two-point function. In the end, it's of square root of epsilon. And the reason I'm writing it this way is because the current experimental bound is of order one. So in order to see the one we get for single field inflation, in the simplest models, we would need to go two orders, of, at least two orders of magnitude beyond what is done now. And you already seen, if you did that plot, you already seen how difficult it is with what's done now. So it's even harder. And so for the epsilon, but it's also a function of the momenta. And what people do in practice is that they take the data and they try to extract a particular non-Gaussianity with a specific function of momentum. Okay, so it's not that they look at the non-Gaussianity for each momentum at a time, because there wouldn't be enough statistics to do that. But they just measure only one number, which is the amplitude of this that particular shape of non-Gaussianity in the data. And they don't do it just for one particular shape, but they do it for various shapes. And they get some numbers, okay? One number for each shape. So maybe there is some, I don't know, crazy shape that is there, but they haven't tested. And there might be a big signal there. Of course, if you test all possible crazy shapes, there will be one that will have some signal, right? Okay, so a few features about this function. Yeah, I was going to discuss that. Yeah. So this depends on three momenta. And the momenta need to be conserved. So it's k1, k2, and k3, right? And of course, we have the isotropy and blah, blah, blah. So it's only a function of the magnitudes of this momenta, not of how it is oriented. So it's just a function of this triangle. Also, rotational, in this particular case, because we're talking about the scalar, there's also no information about parity. So even a parity-violating theory will give something which, in terms of this triangle, is parity-preserving, because parity can be understood as a rotation of the triangle in three dimensions. Okay, so that's this shape. And also, if since the whole calculation is approximately scale invariant, the whole this whole answer is approximately scale invariant. Now, some features about this shape. So as I mentioned already yesterday, if the shape becomes a triangle like that, it's important there is no singularity. And that has to do with the nature of the vacuum, whether we are close or not to the standard vacuum that we assumed yesterday, so which is sometimes called the Bunch-Davis or Euclidean vacuum, or Hartle-Hawking vacuum, or Tagirov-Chernikov vacuum. There are different names for it, all the same. So that's an interesting limit where you expect to find nothing, at least in the simplest model. Yeah, so for this shape, the idea is that there is no singularity if you didn't have this particle in the very beginning. So if in the original state you had a particle with this momentum that can then decay into the two other particles, then you have this, then there will be a singularity. Or that you have these two particles that can then combine into this particle as real physical particles. But when we do this computation, we find that since we didn't have all these particles in the vacuum, energy is not conserved. And that's why we don't get a singularity. So if energy was conserved locally at short distances smaller than the size of the horizon, you would get the singularity. But of course, the whole thing is non-vanishing. I mean, this term is non-vanishing, but it's not particularly singular. And, okay. The other interesting limit is a limit where the triangle looks like this, or like that. So two sides very long, and one side short. That's called the squeeze limit. And this is a rather important and interesting limit to consider. And in this limit, so let me write it in position space. So we have one big momentum, which represents a short mode. So this is sometimes called short. Even though it's the long momentum, it's the short distances, right? And this is sometimes called long. So long and short refer to distances. So the long, so we have a very long mode. So this is the one corresponding to the k long. So this side, k long. And then on top of this, we have some shorter distance fluctuations, right? So this represents the k short, okay? And so we're correlating, calculating roughly the two-point function of this in the presence of a long one. So that's the three-point function we are computing. And in this simplest inflationary situation, one can, this is three-point function, is fixed by a certain consistency condition. So the single field model is what we could call the single clock model. There is only one field that is setting the clock for when everything is happening, when the end of inflation will happen, when the whole after reheating, what's going to happen is set by only a single field. So if that field has some fluctuation like this, and you're looking at shorter distances, you have somehow no way of telling whether the whole clock has been advanced everywhere. Right? This is like a rescaling of the coordinates. It's not visible. You can approximate this thing as a constant, and then you wouldn't be able to see it from the point of view of these short distance fluctuations. Okay. It was like the question that I was asked yesterday, whether k or x couldn't be rescaled. Yeah, they can be rescaled, and that's a gauge symmetry. It's just a choice of coordinates. And so for that reason, one can think about what this three-point function should be. And the idea is that we have these short modes, the two short modes, and we have the long mode, right? So what the long mode does is it really rescales these short modes. And the idea is that the physics would be the same as just rescaling the distances or saying that, well, everything will happen a little later. And so therefore, we can think that all that will happen is that we'll have the two-point function of short distances. And the long mode will only appear in saying what, recall that k star that was appearing in the formula, so the time at which we should evaluate something, that will be changed slightly because we expanded the universe a little more, a little less at longer distances. And this will change only if this result is not scale invariant. So if this we just calculate the scale dependence of this, and then we have the same, the two-point function for the long mode. And the scale dependence of this is proportional to the spectral index, and S minus 1 times the two-point function of the short mode. Okay, so that's the result in this limit. So that's in the limit when k, let's say one of the k's, the k long over k short, goes to 0, then we find this answer. So that's in the, this simplest model with a single clock. If you had extra fields, then this behavior would be modified and you'll have other things. And I'll discuss in a second what other things you will have. But in this single model, you have this plus some corrections, which are down relative to this one by powers of 1 plus the long momentum or the short momentum. This is smaller than this one, squared. And because this guy that is I mean, the whole argument was that this guy was not would not see anything really physical before looking at all the long distances. This is sometimes saying that, well, this is not a real somehow three-point function in the sense that it cannot be measured by some observer just living here. But well, if you could see all the distances, then you could measure it. Okay, so the interesting aspect of this is that in this limit, the answer is the answer for the simplest model is totally fixed, and so any deviation from this is evidence of new things, new physics, new fields, something beyond the simplest model. Okay. I should also have said that since the non-Gaussianity prediction for the simplest model is so small, any observation of non-Gaussianity would be also evidence that either for more fields or for a single field, but let's say non-trivial kinetic terms or non-trivial speed of sound during inflation. So that's why there was interest in understanding these non-Gaussianities. Okay, so I'll, how much? Did I start on time? Oh, okay. Yeah, time. This is the usual redshift when you're close to the blackboard. Similar to a black hole. Times goes more slowly for you. Okay, so I'll now talk about one interesting effect in this squeeze limit, which is which arises when you have new particles. So we're going to imagine that we have new particles, and we'll see from the answers that we'll get that these effects are interesting if the masses are not much bigger than h. So the masses of the particles, in order to see anything, they have to be smaller than a few h. So something, let's say, less than 2h or 3h. So what happens if we have massive particles? So we can have exactly the same Lagrangian that we had before. The only difference is the extra m squared term. And then going through the same type of analysis we did before, we could calculate the classical solution, so sigma classical. And the classical solutions are going to be the equation is essentially Bessel's equation. And so they are some kind of Bessel function. They are these functions that in mathematics are called Hankel functions. They have an index, some index here, and then they're form k eta. So that's our solution. And this is some function which is conceptually similar to the one we discussed before. So it goes like e to the ik eta for very negative eta. This is much bigger than 1. And then for small eta, it goes like eta to the 3 halves times alpha k eta to the minus I mu plus beta k eta to the I mu. And yesterday I said that these two oscillatory behaviors represented the oscillations of the phase of the wave function of a massive particle. Right? So this, in terms of proper times, these factors go like e to the I mu t. And I didn't say what mu was, but mu is related to the mass. So mu is equal to square root. The formula is not important. It's basically the mass in units of H. So for some ranges of masses, mu is real. For some ranges of masses, mu is purely imaginary. So that's for light masses. And these exponents then become real. But basically, all the formulas I'm going to write continue to be valid in those cases. I'm going to think in terms of the case where mu is real. So we can now calculate the two-point function of this massive field. So in the same way that we calculated the two-point function of the massless field before, we can now calculate the two-point function of the massive field. And we'll find something interesting. So we'll find that the two-point function of the massive field, so sigma of k as a function of eta, and sigma of k as a function of eta. And we're going to calculate it at late times, so for k eta much less than 1. We're going to find that this behaves like eta cubed. So it's very simple calculation. It's essentially identical to what we had done before. So we calculate the wave function at late times, and then we take the square of this, right? That's the type of formula we had yesterday. And here we do exactly the same thing. And so we'll get terms of the form. So we'll get the term like k eta to the minus I mu times, let's say, alpha, the square of alpha plus eta. Eta. So we get the square of the first term, the square of the second term, and then a product of these two. Now, the important thing to notice is that when we take the product of the two, the factors of k will cancel out. While if we take the square of each one, the factors of k are going to be present. And that has an interesting implication, so whether there is or there isn't a factor of k, which is whether when we go to position space, we now can go to position space. And in position space, we'll get an interesting non-local expression, so something that is non-vanishing for very different positions, only when we have a non-trivial power of k. Okay. Because the Fourier transform of a power of k, which is 1, is just a delta function. Okay, so pieces which are independent of k, which just give us a delta function, so something that will vanish only for very short distances. And the whole idea is that we are trying to calculate it at very long distances. By very long distances, what I mean is that we are calculating this at some time eta, and we're going to distances which are much bigger than eta. Okay? So we're calculating this two-point function in this regime. And these pieces are going to give, some interesting non-local behavior. So some power of x, which is similar to what you get in conformal invariance. So I'm not going to write it, but you can do the Fourier transform if you want. What is important is that it gives. It's local, yeah. Yes. So when the mass goes to 0, so then we get that mu is plus or minus I times 3/2, right? Or I mu is equal to plus or minus 3/2, right? And then we come here, and one of these two terms will give us the 1 over k cubed, right? And we'll cancel this explicit factor of eta so that it will become eta independent. So only in this case, the answer becomes eta independent of late times. For any other mass which is non-zero, the answer starts decaying at late times. And for massive particles, the decay is eta cubed, which is essentially a volume dilution factor. I mean, this is saying that we create the particles, and then the particles just start separating. And eta cubed is just the volume. So this goes like e to the minus 3t. And e to the t is the volume, so this is 1 over the volume. Okay. And actually, this factor is the square root of the volume, as we have in the in the wave function, because the probabilities are proportional to the wave function squared. Okay, so now, of course, they get diluted, and we cannot see these massive particles directly if they were present. But something that can happen is the following. So we can have a situation where we create the massive particles, and then the massive particles could decay into the curvature fluctuations or the inflaton. So we could have a coupling in the Lagrangian. So this happens due to a coupling in the Lagrangian that contains some lambda term, so some constant, let's say the gradient of the field square times the sigma field. So this is a Lagrangian which is invariant under small shifts of the shift symmetry of pi. So this is a reasonable, let's say, short, this is a reasonable interaction Lagrangian to write down. It doesn't spoil the slow roll condition. And with this interaction Lagrangian, this massive particle can decay into, or can interact with the phi, which, and phi is roughly the same as z at the curvature fluctuation. So then we can see some effect here in the curvature fluctuations. And if this happens at both vertices, then we can see some effect in the four-point function. But if this coupling is, let's say, could come from some term in the gravitational action or is of gravitational strength, then the estimates we did a moment ago for the strength of this effect would still be valid. And the strength of this effect will have a power of g effective square, which was h over m Planck square, which is something of the order of 10 to the minus 9, 10 to the minus 10. That would be very small. But you can make it slightly bigger by making this vertex an interaction with the, so consider now an inflationary background, and this could be the homogeneous solution. So one of the phis could be the homogeneous phi, and then this could be a fluctuation. So here we can have momenta k1, k2, and k3, and here k4 would be equal to 0. And such terms would be proportional to the, since there is a gradient here, will be proportional to the time derivatives of the background field. And the net effect is really proportional only to G effective. So it's typical of a three-point function. And in fact, the ordinary three-point function I was talking about over there can be viewed as the exchange of a massless graviton. So if you have a massless graviton, it's really the graviton of the Newtonian force, essentially. And that one gives you something of that order. And so this is just a generalization for a massive particle. So that's a little bigger. And this stuff has a lot of interesting, so you can calculate what it is, but I'll say what you get, and I'll try to explain the different pieces of what you get. So you calculate the three-point function that comes from this. And so this is a diagram which is suppressed relative to the two-point function diagram of the scalar, right? By a power of G effective. This one. No, this one is not suppressed by a power of eta, because this is produced, let's say, over a Hubble region, and then they decay. We'll discuss the further suppressions. But let's say just the simplest situation would be this is produced over a Hubble time, right, over one expansion time, and then it decays. So there it didn't have too much time to for this to kick in, right? Decay before this started kicking in. And then we'll see in the final formula that if we allow it to stay longer, these factors will kick in, right? So if these momenta are very short, so meaning that this decayed much later, right? So we have a situation where this decay might much later, but then it would affect only very short momenta. And in that case, then we expect to have that, find that suppression factor that you are talking about, right? So we'll see. So the time evolution of that. So here we saw some time, explicit time evolution. And that explicit time evolution will become here just some factors of k long over k short. So let's go to the squeeze limit, where this will be the short momenta, right? There are two of them. And then this will be the k long. The long moment is the k3. And then that time dependence becomes dependence of this form, right? So 3/2, so we had 3/2 plus I mu. So here again, we have 3/2 plus I mu, but now it's the k short over k long, okay? And this is factors relative to what you would have had in the case of the graviton. So I'm going to write this as psi long, psi short, that's what we were having in the case of the graviton, right? So I erased it, but that was the squeeze limit, the behavior. Yeah, I erased it. The behavior in the squeeze limit for the graviton was this, times eta ns minus 1, that's something of order epsilon. Then we have this factor. And this factor can come with an amplitude and a phase, so there will be some phase that depends only on mu, and then a complex conjugate here. So the whole answer should be real. And then there is the magnitude of what appears is proportional to e to the minus pi mu. So that's the behavior for at least large mu. And there is also a factor of lambda times M Planck. And then this is of order epsilon. So. OK, so the point is that the most interesting aspect of this is this oscillatory behavior together with a predicted phase, because this phase can be computed by computing the phases that appear in this formula together with some extra phases that appear by doing these Fourier transforms. But they are all determined by the theory. So all these phases are completely fixed. Lambda is just real because it's a Hermitian term in the Lagrangian. So these phases are completely fixed by the theory. And so if you could see these oscillations in the three-point function, you would be able to make a real test of quantum mechanics. And notice that this phase is also characteristic of interference effects. So really, this expression for the three-point function, you should view it as an interference effect between the case that we have no particles, no particle creation, plus a pair of particles, pair creation. So we have, in the wave function of the universe, we have the piece that was just completely Gaussian and so on. And then we have the probability of creating a pair. And the leading correction, since we have some very small effective coupling here, the leading correction is just an interference effect between the two. And that's what this is saying. And you can see this interference effect in various places. First, notice that the volume dilution factor is only the square root of the volume. So it's a factor of 3/2 and not 3. So that's one feature that shows you that. Then this Boltzmann suppression factor, this is related to the fact that when the mass becomes very large, it's very improbable to produce these particles, or to really physically produce the particles. So here we are getting a non-local effect because we are really physically producing the particles. There are other contributions to the three-point function, which are not in the squeeze limit, which are only power suppressed by mu, but they are more like could be also mimicked by local interactions of the inflaton. That would arise from integrating out this massive field. But these non-local effects, you are really physically producing the field, or more precisely, we are having an interference between producing it and non-producing it. And if you really were to physically produce it, you expect a factor of e to the minus m over t, okay? T is 2 pi h, so this is h times 2 pi, or mu times 2 pi. So there's a factor of 2 difference. And that's related to the fact that the probability for creating the pair is the square of this thing, right? And that will give us the factor of 2 pi, but we get only a factor of pi. So this correction is really, it's like a quantum mechanical effect. It's an interference between two processes. It's like having the double slit experiment in cosmology, where they have one slit corresponds to not creating the particles. The other slit corresponds to creating the particles, and you're interfering these two. So those are features. If lambda is of order n Planck, this factor is of order 1, that's a natural value for lambda. You could have bigger values of lambda, and then this, that would make this effect more observable. And it would be interesting to see whether it is there or not. So second is that this, as Pedro was asking, so when KL is much shorter than K, when KL when KL is smaller than K short, and you have a big hierarchy, this factor of 3/2 is not helping you very much. It's suppressing this. So there are many suppression factors. So one is that one. The other is this one. There are these two suppression factors that make this effect even smaller than the fact that hasn't yet been seen. So the idea is you first would see the effects from single field inflation or from the graviton, and then you would see a smaller correction that is due to these other new particles. This lies way into the future, so I don't think it's going to be seen next year. So that's in order to see it, but of course, it depends on what the theory is. It depends on whether the particles are really present or not. I mean, there might not be such particles. Now, one motivation for finding such particles is a supersymmetric theory. So imagine you had a supersymmetric theory. Then if inflation, so the potential that gives rise to inflation breaks supersymmetry spontaneously, then the partners of the inflaton tend to have masses. So in supersymmetry, each scalar comes in, always has another partner, which is another scalar. And the other scalar will have mass, which is of order h. So it would be in this type of regime. And so there were several papers written on this story. I'm not giving all the references. You can find them on the internet. Okay. And then finally, there is another interesting thing, which is that I've discussed the case of a scalar particle, but you can have here a particle with spin. So this could be a particle with spin s. And then when you have a particle with spin s, there is an extra factor here, which is PS, so the Legendre polynomial of cosine of theta, where theta is some angle. And so theta is an angle in this triangle. So we discussed this triangle of the squeeze limit. And so you have the long momenta, which are almost parallel. And then you have this short, you have the large momenta, which correspond to short modes. And then you have this little one here. And you can define this angle theta. And so we get the Legendre polynomial as a function of theta. So in an ideal world, we will measure this Legendre polynomial, so this function of angle, and we would be able to tell what spin this particle had. If you found, let's say, spin 2, massive spin 2, you would be a bit surprised. You would say, well, there's a massive spin 2 particle. Maybe there are extra dimensions or something like this. If you found the spin 4 particle, you would be even more surprised. Because if you had a light spin 4 particle, it means that you will have probably some kind of deviation from general relativity already at scale which is close to h. So that is possible in a situation only when, I guess I should say a few words, which is, let me discuss this issue of spin and how surprising would it be to find a spin 4 particle. So you would be able to find what the mass is, so you calculate the mass from the frequency of the oscillation. That then will tell you the coupling, let's say, is of order n Planck, so it will be weakly coupled. And then you calculate the spin. And how surprising would it be to find some particle of spin 4? So it's again a system of weakly interacting particles of higher spin. And we think that the following is true. So there is the following conjecture. If you have weakly interacting particles, of spin s greater than 2, or let's say great s spins bigger than 4, then it should be some kind of string theory. Now, the birth of string theory was to try to do this because people found weakly interacting higher spin particles in hadron colliders, and they were led to string theory as a solution of a consistent theory of all these interacting higher spin particles. And the question is whether that's the only solution or whether there are other theories. And at least to my knowledge, there is no other solution than some kind of string theory. I mean, it could be a large N gauge theory that has a dual string theory description, but it's always some kind of string theory. And so, well, that's a conjecture that is very natural. And so, of course, one of the exercises could be to prove it. And if you did, you could write a very famous paper. And so assuming that is true, then, I mean, this I suspect is a provable statement, but maybe by bootstrap techniques and use of Mathematica and so on to guide you, you might be able to prove it. But assuming it is true, it would say that if you found higher spins, then you should have some strings. So it would be an indirect way to probe for the existence of strings. And so by this method, we could probe strings whose masses are of order h. And h is, so the highest h would be 10 to the 14 GeV. So this is a very, this inflationary period is the highest energy accelerator we can have, or the most powerful microscope. And it could explore distances which are as short as this one, perhaps a little longer. And so in some sense, we have a cosmological collider, and we need to be able to extract physics from it, so to extract the signals. And the signals are buried in all these non-Gaussianities. So they are extremely difficult to see in practice, and even in principle. So let me just discuss in principle what. So it's not that the CMB experimentalists have not measured the CMB well enough. Even if you measure the CMB for the angles that have been measured exactly, so imagine you had no errors, you had no dust, no nothing, but you measured from L equal to 2 to 1,000, which is what they, a few thousand, to, which is what they do, then it wouldn't be enough to actually measure a three-point function which is of this order. Because of this effect called cosmic variance. So the fact that we are doing this experiment of, well, we're doing the experiment only once. So we are observing only one instance of this random distribution. And from this one instance, we have to understand the underlying distribution. So the best we can do is we can take the pieces of the sky and then average over different pieces. And in order to have more possibility of discriminating between different underlying distributions, you need to look at primordial fluctuation modes, which are of shorter and shorter distances, so that you have more and more points in the sky. And I'm told that with the CMB, we've more or less done as well as we can do with those set of modes. And then there will have to be some other cosmological probes of the primordial fluctuations, either using the distribution of galaxies that will allow you a little more, and also there is something more futuristic, which is called the 21 centimeter tomography, which still hasn't yet been measured. But perhaps if one is lucky, one will be able to see more modes. So if we live in a universe where such experiments are possible, then there is a throw of data that could be found. But we don't know whether we live in such a universe. OK, thank you. Yeah. I wanted to talk more about the less speculative parts. Here I discussed a few things here with this non-Gaussianity, which are some kind of test of the quantum nature of these fluctuations, because they are things that we can calculate using quantum mechanics, and then we could check whether they are correct or not. If you imagine that the fluctuations were produced in a different way, then you would probably not see this type of three-point function and so on. But now you can ask, you can go to the other extreme and say, well, can I ever even prove very, very convincingly? How convincingly could I possibly prove that these fluctuations are quantum mechanical? And so normally when we talk about proofs of quantum mechanics, one very striking proof is the existence of Bell inequalities. Also, we were talking about entanglement in the early universe, right? So we said, well, this is an entangled state and so on. How do you convince someone that you have an entangled state? Well, if you can violate Bell's inequalities, then you convince someone that but in order to measure Bell's inequalities, you have to have an entangled state and measure two non-commuting observables here and two non-commuting observables here, B and B prime. So A and A prime are two observables that do not commute with each other. This could be like A could be a spin projection along one direction and A prime spin projection along a different direction, right? And then you compare the answers and so on. Can we do this in cosmology? Can we find, let's say we have the fluctuations, can we do something in this region and something in this region of the sky? And then we look at these regions and find some suitable things we can measure and then derive a Bell inequality. If we are, okay, so the answer to this question, the first answer is no. And the reason is that we said that we are going to measure this, we have this distribution, that everything we are going to see depends purely on this distribution, which is a distribution for the shape of zeta. So it's just the position of the harmonic oscillator, but not the momentum. So we don't really have access to the momentum. It simply, it's not that it is theoretically impossible, it's just practically not what we can measure. So we cannot measure the momentum of these oscillators. So anything that we observe in cosmology depends on the somehow position of the oscillator. So therefore, if we just do this, then it just simply doesn't work. But you can do a little better, which is comparable to, is in the same kind of spirit of what we are saying here for the massive particles. So massive particles cannot be detected directly, but they can be detected indirectly. And here also, what you can do is you can imagine that you produce some entangled state, which could be, for example, a massive particle with spin. And then it decays. And then you observe this somehow these decay products. And somehow the information about these decays propagates all the way to the end of inflation and also to our current time. And then you can perhaps see some of these interference effects, or at least these massive particles. But this Bell stuff has one more complication, which is that you need to decide where to measure A or A prime. And in the Bell experiment, this is done by a local decider variable. So there is a decider variable here. So here you have some local variable which tells you whether you measure A or A prime, and similarly here. And the guy here that is measuring this has to also know what the value of this decider variable is. And so you can make that in this case by having a second field. So there is here one massive field that with spin that produces the entangled state. Then there is a second field which produces some fluctuations which are local to this region. And you can have, you can, depending on the value of this field, you will either measure the spin in one an axis or a different axis. This could be like an axion field. And then there should be some mechanism that detects the result of the measurement. And you can do that by coupling these massive particles to the inflaton and produce certain hotspots in the inflationary fluctuation. So if you have a massive particle whose mass depends on the inflaton, then dm d phi gives you a linear source for the inflaton, right? And that implies that when we solve the equations, we'll have some, let's say we had the random fields we had before. But if we have such a particle, we might have an overall displacement. And so the whole fluctuations could be displaced, and this might in principle be seen. So I'm not saying that our universe contains these particles. I'm just saying that there are some other universes which are logically reasonable and where you could, in principle, do such an experiment. So it's just a proof of principle that you could do a Bell-type experiment, at least if the theory is simple enough. Now, I mean, sorry, if the theory is complicated enough, you can do it with some simple observations. And one question that I don't know the answer to is whether it can be done in the simplest inflationary model, so where you can do this in the simplest single field inflationary model. And it's not obvious that it can be done. In fact, it seems quite difficult. We started out trying to find a way to do it in the simplest inflationary model, but we failed. And the main reason that you fail is that you want here to have some entanglement at long distances, and you want these decider variables and the whole measurement process to be somewhat classical, right? In the sense that you can be some evolution, some quantum evolution, that can be viewed as a measurement process, right? That's a special type of quantum evolution. It's not the most generic quantum evolution. And so for that, you need some variables that are behaving more or less classical at these times. But we've seen yesterday that that for the single field case, things become classical when they cross the horizon. So if we look at some entanglement for long distances, those modes would have crossed the horizon earlier than these shorter decider variable modes. And therefore, there would be more, these longer ones would be more classical, so it would be harder to detect the entanglement. So that was the main difficulty. That's conceptually where the difficulty lies. Here, you don't have that difficulty because the entanglement is in the spin variable, which is somehow there. The quantum variable is somehow locked in with the particle, and you can separate it as much as you want, and it doesn't become more classical. It stays quantum mechanical. So, in fact, this discussion doesn't test the quantum mechanics of the fluctuations of the inflaton. It only detects that whatever is producing these hotspots had a quantum mechanical origin. So it was only the spin variable that had the quantum mechanical origin, though. That's the only thing that it tests. So that's more or less that story.